From Santa Cruz, California, I'm Gary Shapiro, and this is From the Bookshelf. Thanks so much for joining me. I'm always happy to have Jennifer Cation Armstrong on the show. She's the author of several wonderful books, including Mary and Lou and Rhoda and Ted, and all the brilliant minds who made the Mary Tyler Moore Show a classic. Seinfeldia, How a Show About Nothing Changed Everything. Sex and the City and Us, How Four Single Women Changed the Way We Think, Live, and Love. So Fetch, The Making of Mean Girls and Why We're Still Obsessed with It. And her brilliant history of the birth of television. When women invented television, the untold story of the female powerhouses who pioneered the way we watch today. Jennifer Cation Armstrong, welcome back to From the Bookshelf.
Thank you for having me again.
It's always good to talk to you. And I just realized I failed to mention your wonderful Pop Star Goddesses book, which is one of my personal favorites.
Thank you.
And you've been sort of on the Eras tour where you're... you're revisiting all of your old works on Instagram and YouTube.
Yeah, it's true. I mean, I know I mentioned this somewhere, but, you know, in some cases, it's hard to believe this, but social media wasn't what it was even 10 years ago. So when something like Mary and Lou came out, I was like trying to figure out how I was supposed to be doing this, but it really wasn't like what it is now. You couldn't do all these cool things. Like, I've been on TikTok in the years since, and sometimes I'll make little like short documentaries, you know, about certain aspects of the subjects I cover, that kind of thing. And this was just not something you could easily do in 2013. So I've kind of been doing this for that reason. And also, honestly, because I looked at our fave Taylor Swift's career and I saw what she was doing recently between the Eras Tour and re-releasing all of her old records. And I was like, this woman is a genius, right? The way she's getting people to rebuy all of her stuff, which I can't quite do. I can't put out like new versions of these books, but just like, there's no reason you should stop talking about stuff you did in the past, especially when there's new things to add or new ways to look at it. So that was kind of, it really was directly inspired by Taylor's brilliant business acumen.
Well, I think we first met when you wrote Mary and Lou and Rhoda and Ted and all the brilliant minds who made the Mary Tyler Moore Show a classic. And I loved the show. So naturally I was thinking, oh, a book about that. I want to read it. And I want to talk to the author, which is how we met.
Yeah.
And I love that book. It's a very good book. But one thing I've noticed about your writing is that you're such a much better writer now than you were then. I didn't realize it until I got to, you know, The Women Who Invented Television, which I thought was so brilliant.
Thank you.
Do you have an urge? Would you ever go back and look at it and think, oh, I want to do Jennifer's version of Mary?
It's an interesting thought. And maybe I would do it more like in some other way, like wouldn't just rewrite the book, but like I can imagine a world in which you do like a collection where maybe I kind of like revisit each of the shows that I've written about. Because the thing is that also things change. Now, in television, no matter what, even an old show, and I don't think this was something that I felt when I first started doing these kinds of books, but I really feel it now, that the life goes on even if there's no reboot, God willing, right? And first of all, there's like always the possibility of a reboot coming and smashing everyone's dreams, I mean, or making us happy, like Sex in the City was, you know, something that happened in the lifespan of that show.
Did it make you happy or make you
No, I love to hate that show. I think I've been pretty public about it. It was hard for me at first because those people were so nice to me. And yeah, they're really fine people who are very smart and make wonderful work. This isn't it.
I didn't get very far in the reboot because I just hated it.
It's pretty bad. It's pretty bad. And I kind of love to hate it now. Like me and my friends watch it just to kind of complain about it. It's the way that show is, but yeah, it's not great. But even without something like that, like I think Seinfeld is probably blessedly gonna kind of leave well enough alone, unless, you know, they've done these like pokes at it via Curb Your Enthusiasm. But, you know, even with that, like it's on Netflix now, which makes it different. It's a whole different audience discovering it. People, you know, writing think pieces about it again, all of this stuff hitting a new generation in a different way. And so there's always something going on with television now. And there's always sort of a path forward for this stuff.
It's also interesting how the passage of time changes public opinion of a classic. I mean,
yes.
Seinfeld, for instance, or I think it's more Friends. We hear a lot. People now criticize Friends for being politically incorrect and having a lot of homophobic humor in it and things like that, which nobody seemed to mind when it happened 5 minutes ago.
Crazy. It's actually very, it's a very interesting, I think, effect of streaming is that, you know, I don't, even in Friends era, I don't think they might have been thinking, oh, people will still watch this on DVD because that was happening by then. But there's something else about it just sort of being there on TV that you can watch at any time. So that means like when you used to have to buy a DVD, you'd have to be a fan to go get the DVD. So you're predisposed to like not be mad at the show. Whereas if you're just like switching through, oh, I've always meant to see Friends, you start watching, you're like, why do they hate gay people? Because I have to tell you, like, you know, it is, I know people like to roll their eyes to some extent. And I understand about like, look, things change, you know, you don't have to write a think piece just because things are different from 2000 to now. On the other hand, when I rewatch Friends, which is a very funny, well-done show, I rewatched it recently and I was like, oh, there really is a lot of this. Like it's very jarring when we've changed our minds so quickly about this stuff. And man, there really is a homophobic joke like every episode. It's very strange. You kind of start to wonder like, what is your problem? Like you're just like, you guys seem really concerned about this. I don't know what your problem is. It's very strange that that used to just be the ether. That used to just be the environment we lived in and we didn't think about it. So I think it's great that we think it's bad now, you know?
Well, I mean, it's sort of the same with radio, like in the old golden age of radio. Every radio program had a dialect comedian come on for 2 minutes, you know, Park Your Carcass or Mr. Ketzel or Mrs. Nussbaum. Every show had that. And the reason they had it is because they were funny and people enjoyed them. and of course, the most famous radio program was Amos and Andy, which was two, you know, blackface minstrel comedians. And, you know, nobody until 1960, nobody objected to it.
Yeah, that one's so interesting, too. We don't have to get too far into it. But I did encounter that show when I was writing When Women Invented Television. And so I learned a lot about it. And there was a really interesting dynamic even at the time. It's like you think this stuff is modern because we have blogs or Substacks now or social media. But really, like the debates were kind of similar. And there was a lot of Black people at the time who hated it. And there were a lot of Black people at the time who were like, look, at least we're getting representation, you know, like, this is the only show that's even really representing us. And some of this stuff might be a little, you know, some of the stereotypes might have some basis in truth. And this was just what I saw in the newspaper columns at the time. And then on the other hand, there were civil rights activists writing letters immediately and being like, this cannot be on television.
Right.
So,
I mean, at least when it was on television, they actually
on television.
Had an American
yeah.
playing the part.
That's right. I mean, that was almost like there were talks of doing other crazy things that I saw where they were going to have like a Black man play him, but lip sync to the white man still giving his voice. It was another time. But it just shows you how also things don't change as much as you think. You know what I mean? Both in terms of we have not overcome racism and in terms of the debates that we have about representation.
In fact, Freeman Godson and Charles Carell, the two actors who played Amos and Andy, they did a cartoon show called Calvin and the Colonel, where they played two dogs that spoke in the voices of Amos and Andy after the show was taken off the air.
So weird. Like the things they come up with to kind of like end run around and be like, we're still kind of doing that show, but we're pretending we're not.
Yeah. No, you know, that's the thing. I mean, we consider ourselves so enlightened now. And when we look at these things and we have a sort of a satisfied attitude. Well, we don't do that anymore. We don't tolerate that anymore. But do you think that, especially in terms of your pop star goddesses, that we will look back in 20 years at Megan Thee Stallion or Nicki Minaj and think, well, we tolerated a lot of stuff then that we wouldn't tolerate now?
Probably only because we do it now, right? Like we just talked about, and maybe change will be slower because we just, I think, really went through maybe a 20-year period of extremely rapid change on this particular, on the front of like racial and gender and all of that kind of representation and et cetera. This is something that I can remember when I was at Entertainment Weekly. I feel like it's so crazy now that I'm like, when I was a young whipper, like this is so old now. But when I was at Entertainment Weekly in the 2000s, it was still a little like, it wasn't done as much to talk about social issues on television. That was like my beat and no one else was doing it. Like, I don't mean to say I'm like this big pioneer. I just mean it was what was interesting to me. And I was like an outlier. Like, no, everyone just wanted to know like what was going to happen on Grey's Anatomy. And the way that this is such the bread and butter now of the way that everyone, not only journalists, but regular people talk about television. There was, you know, I keep thinking while we're talking about this, about the recent uproar over Nobody Wants This on Netflix. Mm-hmm. And which is a fantastically watchable show starring Adam Brody and Kristen Bell, romantic comedy. He's a rabbi. She's a shiksa. Pandemonium ensues. But like there has been this very loud discussion about the way that Jewish people are depicted on the show, particularly like his family and, you know, who are upset about the shiksa. And, you know, that just shows you that, like, this is just something, this is just in the water now. This is how we talk about television. And regular people, as much as journalists, are sort of having these discussions.
Well, that's because one of the things from the past that has been recently rebooted is anti-Semitism.
True.
A huge comeback. True.
Making a comeback.
Yeah.
The gritty version, you know, in the reboot. And it's, no, it's true. And I mean, I think it's actually, yeah, I think it can be good. I at least like that. I mean, I think TV, this is the basis of all of my writing, right? I think TV can really give us a way of talking about a lot of this stuff that makes it a little safer. It's like, if you're talking about it on this show, Nobody Wants This, it's like a little easier for dinner conversation than, you personally, I think you are anti-Semitic. Let's talk about it, right? You can ease into it or whatever. Yeah. And I just think it gives us ways of talking. And I've always felt that way. And the shows I love best and the shows I love to write about are the ones that do this. And like the Mary Tyler Moore Show was a pioneer at this, right? At bringing this stuff up in a way that's, you know, a little bit less threatening and fun, but still relevant and important. And, you know, helped pave the way for the women's movement.
Yeah, I agree. Of course, I loved the Mary Tyler Moore Show. And the thing about the books that you've written, and it didn't even feel that way when you wrote Seinfeldia, which I don't know, how old is Seinfeldia?
That's 2016.
Yeah, so it's not even 10 years old. But yeah. It was Seinfeld and maybe a little bit of Sex and the City are the shows when people still all watched the same thing. I mean, today when you mention the Kristen Bell Show, which I've seen one episode of so far, I mean, most people haven't. I mean, whenever you talk to anybody, they say, are you watching blah, blah, blah? And you say, mm-hmm. No, I don't know that. You're not watching blah, blah, blah. It's so great. It doesn't really get going until season 5, but you got to see.
this is exactly the conversation. You just have to plow through, but it's so great. You should totally do it. I've started to actually have, because people love to talk to me particularly about this stuff, because they think I have a better chance of knowing blah show, which half the time I still don't, which is a crazy thing. But, you know, I've just started saying everything on television is good. I'm sure this is good. I can only watch so many things. Like, I cannot promise you I'm going to watch your show that you love.
That's right. And so, but that wasn't true. I mean, I'm a lot older than you, but, you know, especially this time of year when the TV Guide preview issue would come out, you'd be so excited about all the new shows, and all those shows would stay on until, you know, for 26 weeks. And then. Yeah. You know, some of them would come back again. And, you know, there was just 3 networks and you had to you watched what was on and everybody watched it. Everybody, right. You know.
It's just what you like. This is just how it is. Like a thing with Seinfeld is that so many times interviewers will ask me something like, oh, are you a big Seinfeld fan? And I should just say yes, and that'd be easier. But what I say instead, because it feels disingenuous to me. My identity is not as a Seinfeld fan. It's as a something like it is kind of as a Beyonce fan or a Taylor Swift fan. So that's why I'm like, feel weird claiming that. Yeah. So I usually say like, what you need to know is just that, like, if you were alive in the 90s, like you just watched Seinfeld and you watched TV. It would be crazy if you didn't watch Seinfeld. Like, I don't know what was up against it, but it doesn't matter, because what you did is you watched it on Thursday so you could go to work or school on Friday and know what everybody was talking about. They'd all be running around saying soup Nazi, no soup for you. And if you hadn't watched the show, You're like, I don't know what's happening today.
Right. I mean, I wouldn't identify as a Gilligan's Island fan, but I watched every episode.
That's right. That's exactly. It's just, and I'm just mentioning this because you know this stuff as well as I do, and it's fun to talk about. But I recently did an interview about Perfect Strangers, of all things, because it's kind of been coming up in some media lately.
Sure.
And, you know, that's another one where I was like, well, I wouldn't be a fan of that. But I was a kid when it was on, and somehow when I looked it up on Wikipedia, I knew like half the facts about it. You know, I was like, the guy's name is Larry and there's Balky and this. It's like, why do I know that? I don't know. Was it a good show? Was I a fan? No.
No.
You just watched things that were on the television.
Lately, Robin and I have been watching Just Shoot Me, which I had never watched a single episode of when it was on the air. But now I enjoy it quite a bit.
It's kind of good. That one's
pretty
like...
funny.
I remember revisiting it at some point, and it's like, it's such a, to me, that one is like such a sitcom. That's the only way I can describe it, is like,
Yeah.
there was this kind of
Classic
sitcom
sitcom.
in the, what is that, 90s?
Yeah.
Where that's like, just, it's not Seinfeld. It didn't change anything.
It's just funny.
Nobody's likely to do a book about it.
Yeah.
I
Except
love,
Jennifer.
one of my favorite games is to figure out like the weirdest, like the most random show I could say to my agent and see
I'm
which.
going to write a book about My Mother, the Car.
Yeah, exactly. And it's like, that's just one. It's like, didn't do anything important, but like, it's fun. And people just watched what was on TV then. So cool. Gave
Yeah.
us Wendy Malick. Great.
But she's great.
She's great.
Well, of course, you did write a book about the Mickey Mouse Club. That was your
I
first
did.
book.
We could do a whole episode about that journey.
You know, I watch the Mickey Mouse Club every day.
Sure. Yeah, that, I mean, in retrospect, like there's a lot of things wrong with that book, but it's really fun too. I did not choose to revisit it in my Eras tour,
No.
but you know, it did. It first of all, I got to interview a bunch of people who had been Mouseketeers in the 50s. Like, how
Annette
cool is that?
Funicello? Annette Funicello, did you get
She
to talk
was
to her?
not well by the
Oh,
time I
you're
was
sorry,
doing
you
it,
don't.
so. She had not died yet, but she just couldn't do anything, which is too bad because she's obviously like the
The
linchpin
most,
of the
yeah.
operation. But yeah, it was fun to talk to people who were like some of the first child stars, and they were all so lovely. And it also just like, that book is important only because, so what happened with that book is that a publisher was actually looking for someone to write a book about the 1950s Mickey Mouse Club. I wasn't like, this is going
Oh,
to be
you
my
yeah.
first book.
But it did create a genre for you that's really.
Right. That's exactly what it did, is I had not considered this as an option before. And so I thought, like, I'm going to do this and let them pay me. And then the next time I'm going to pick a show that means something to me, because the challenge of that book was writing about something I wasn't alive for and didn't have any particular passion for. So even like when I went to promote it, I didn't really even know what to do. Because it was like they weren't my people, if that makes sense. Whereas, like, I knew what to do when I was going to talk about the Mary Tyler Moore Show or whatever.
Well, I heard you say, Jennifer Cation Armstrong, that when you wrote Mary and Lou and Rhoda and Ted and all the brilliant minds who made the Mary Tyler Moore Show a classic, that you did not realize the book was not a smash success, that you're you thought it must be very successful.
Yeah, you know, I think it's so interesting to think about what success means to people in book world. But there was a progression, right? Because I got to tell you, the Mickey Mouse Club book was like a bomb. And there's reasons for that. There's business reasons for that, including the fact that the publisher who commissioned it died.
Oh,
Yeah, that'll do it.
yeah.
So I actually didn't know that was a bomb until later either. That was like a possible career killer for real. And then when Mary and Lou came out, like, it felt successful because it wasn't that. It wasn't what had happened there, which was utter deadly silence upon the release of that book. Mary had like a nice, you know, like nice stuff happened. I got a review, which is, this is crazy. I haven't gotten it for a while now. I got a review in the New York Times. That was nice. That was pretty exciting. That's probably the biggest thing. But like, you know, I got a blurb from Carol Burnett and a blurb from Peter Biskind, who was a hero of mine. And, you know, Mindy Kaling wrote me a note, and so did BJ Novak. Like, it felt to me like this, you know, stuff was happening in the world. And
you were on From the Bookshelf. Don't forget that.
I was on this. Like, I did do a ton of podcasts. I met most of, I have like people like you. I have a few really wonderful like regulars, essentially, where I'm like, if a book comes out, I call them. They'll have me on. It's great. And, you know, I made a lot of my contacts that way from that book. I sent myself on tour for the first time. I didn't, it is not paid for by the publisher, but like I went to LA and Chicago and did New York. And, you know, also just from that book, like I met a bunch of my heroes. Like I met not only Valerie Harper from the show and Cloris Leachman, but also for me, the biggest thing is people I'm still friends with, which are the female writers of the show. So like, the fact that I just traded emails with Treva Silverman again recently, you know, like it felt great to me. And it wasn't until later when we were negotiating my next book that my agent kind of in passing said something like, well, I really took a bath on that whole Mary and Lou thing. So the fact that they're just going to give you the same advance again is kind of nice.
and you were like, what?
And I was like, oh, I guess. And it, to be honest, I've looked it up later and I may have said this in that video, but you know, I've looked it up since. And it really like did, it's been slowly and steadily continuing to sell a little bit.
Right, it's still in print, right?
The numbers are not terrible. I've had worse numbers on things that you'd think would be better, like Sex and the City. So, you know, when Mary died, we did another printing of it. I did a bunch of media around that. I know it sounds morbid, but it's what happens
most of the time when people die. Yeah. I mean, like, I wanted to talk about Mary Tyler Moore because I loved her. So who else would I call but you? We did it.
Yeah. I mean, that's, you know, I actually have this thing where I'm like, I hope these people realize that what's going to happen is when they die, we will be the ones that they call, that people call to talk about them. Because it's really true that just the biggest thing that can happen, there can't be a lot of news. The biggest thing that can happen, especially on old shows and entertainment in general, is someone's death. So that's when we assess their legacy.
Well, I mean, it is a time to look back on people who have, you know, been important to you. And Mary Tyler Moore was, she was 80, but that's young.
That's pretty young. I mean, I was always sort of sad, you know, she was lifelong diabetic. And I think that just took its toll eventually, because I think she just felt like a person who otherwise was really out there. I mean, she wrote several books, she produced, she was on stage sometimes. And I think we would have seen more of her if not for that, but she still has an incredible legacy.
And she was a pioneer of terrible reboots of classic show. She did that Mary and Rhoda. That was a terrible.
That Mary and Rhoda is really something. I loved watching that because, and I think I had to fight to get that on like a DVD or something for the book, but I might've even gotten a weird bootleg copy or something, but you know, it just made me think like, oh, that could have been really cool. Right? Like imagine, because I'm always on now for reasons that I guess are obvious, that I'm aging too. But, you know, I'm always on now about like, why don't we see more middle-aged women on television? And it would have been really cool to have like Mary and Rhoda living in New York in middle age together, being
single.
They just
needed better writers.
I know. I can't remember the year it was, but it was too early. Like it was before its time, I think.
Yeah, yeah. Oh, there was Golden Girls. That was the one about older.
We haven't had anything as good since. Like, that's the thing about it.
Well, the reason that Golden Girls worked and still works if people watch it is because they had good writers.
Yeah.
Well written.
It's really, really, really true. And the actresses are incredible as well. But, you know, and like much has been made about this, but the women on Just Like That are like the same age. The Sex and the City reboot, if people don't know, are the same age as the Golden Girls were when they started, which is kind of mind-boggling to most of us because of just the way we perceive age. Because Golden Girls was presented as like old ladies, you know, living out their final years together. And it's like not really true if you watch it as an adult and you see what they... I just rewatched some of it and they at some point in the first season or two do say how old some of them are. And I was like, what? Like, if you were like 55?
Right. Well, but you know, people also aged differently. Like, well, I remember, you know, thinking of Maude as being an older character. And that was, you know.
And what is she, like 45 or something?
Yeah, yeah. And also Phyllis. And of course, you know. And but people, they had gray hair and people didn't dye their hair as easily then as they do now.
Everything. I mean, it just
Jennifer,
shows you how much we have.
I should tell my listeners.
Yeah. I mean, there's a theory out there on the internet that I think is kind of right, which is also just short hair theory. Women used to cut their hair short. It's that there was just like one day you woke up and you were like 47 and you're like, today is the day. I have to have like a poof of hair around my head now. And that's just how it has to be. And so somebody did this hilarious thing where they put the short hair on like, Jennifer Aniston and J-Lo. And it kind of is true. Like it makes, if they showed up like that, granted their faces look incredible too, but like, and their bodies, but it really was like, oh, they just put the Golden Girls hair on like some modern women in their 50s. And it was like, yeah, this is a huge part of it. And if one of them also went gray, like
that's
they
the
would
end of
look
it.
Like the Arthur.
But of course, people are living much longer in 2024 than they were living in 1992 or whatever.
That's true too. So you're like the, whatever that would be, it's like almost like the phase of your life might actually perceptually be different.
That's why I'm young, even
yeah,
though.
That's right. I mean, it's weird too, because it just changes as you age, right? So me watching Golden Girls, I think it was during the pandemic, like everything was at some point, I was like, sure, let's do this. And realizing like, oh, I'm almost Golden Girls age. It's very different from watching it as a kid when I was just like, obviously 50 is old,
Yeah, that's right. Another thing that's happened to television shows, like I couldn't imagine a time when people would not be aware of I Love Lucy, that I Love Lucy was the classic. Mm-hmm. Everybody watched it and everybody knew it and everybody always knew it. But I think today people don't know I Love Lucy as well.
That's a little chilling. I think you're right. I think we're getting, this is another thing I've noticed, not to make this all about aging today, but like, it's definitely something I've noticed, and it gives me a weird feeling of vertigo as I get older, certain things like this in general, where you're just like, oh my God, they don't know. Cause you're right. Like the way that TV history has unfolded, TV history starts in like, let's go with 1950. Right. Mm-hmm. So like when I was a kid in the 80s, that's only 30 years ago. So of
Right.
course it's still in circulation and in people's living memory. Someone alive then remembered watching I Love Lucy at the time it was on. And it felt very old to me, but it was like ancient history to me, but it was really only 30 years. So then you do that crazy thing where you're like, okay, well, the equivalent of that is the 90s now.
Yeah.
That's like watching Seinfeld now.
That's right.
So that's crazy. Like, so of course that they can't know everything.
That's
And
right.
I also hate when people sort of like yell at younger people for not knowing
You
things.
don't know the Honeymooners?
Yeah. It's like, how on earth would a Gen Z kid know the Honeymooners? I
Right.
kind of want them to still know I Love Lucy, but it's like, they can't, they weren't alive. It's not their fault. Like they can't know this stuff.
No, they're too busy watching blah, blah, blah. Season
That's
five.
right. That's right. That show you haven't heard of. And I'm not 100% clear on how kids watch TV now or what they're watching
or if
you
they watch. I mean, they don't want
know.
to watch anything that's longer than 13 seconds.
Well, exactly. I mean, so many people really are on TikTok, and TikTok is getting better and worse in a lot of ways. And it's why I try to be on it sometimes, to be honest, is so I like know what the kids are into. And yeah, I mean, I think some watch TV. It's weird because they could just as well be watching Seinfeld as they could be watching Euphoria as they could be watching TikTok. It's like everything is available now.
Everything is available now, except one thing, and that is going to the movies with 300 people.
So true. It's so true. When Barbie happened last year, I really loved that. I went a couple times, and it was, I mean, because I actually like this movie is like an expression of my inner soul. But also
I agree.
Like part of it was that I went like three times, and all three times it was like packed. It was my local theater.
Oh,
It was
nice.
with kids and adults and old people. Like we were all laughing at different times because there's different
Levels of
era jokes. And it was great. It was so
and I
exciting.
always wonder, I mean, I think the movie lets you know right away that it's not a kid's silly movie by having the 2001 A Space Odyssey thing. And
Yeah.
I'm sure that a lot of people look at that and had no idea what they, what,
I was wondering about that, and I was like, I guess this is still funny. I think it's still funny, even if you don't.
Funny if you know it. But
sometimes you can kind of sense when you're younger, you can sense that it's a reference, even though it's not a reference, you know. But there are, I mean, to me, that movie, I could be wrong, because maybe it spans even bigger than this, but I felt super targeted by that movie. I'm like, and I tend to, with my cultural references, fall into young Gen X, old millennial. Like the songs that they, you know, the song that Ken plays, and even in Closer to Fine, Indigo Girls, like that was so like genetically imprinted upon me. And the Pride and Prejudice reference with Colin Firth, like so many of that stuff, those things felt like, oh, Barbie's a millennial. That's cool. Good to know. Barbie's an old millennial.
Also a baby boomer, because I related in the same way to the movie. And I enjoyed the film a lot. And it was a kind of a comeback to the theaters, and so did Oppenheimer. But still, it wasn't a lasting comeback to theater. I still go to if I go to the movies, which I rarely do. There's only, you know, three people there.
Well, there's just, I mean, I've had this feeling. I used to go to the movies in the 90s, like I saw a bunch of stuff where it'd just be like, I don't know, you would say, I am going to the movies. Then you would look at what was playing.
Right.
And you like pick the best option for you and your friends on a Friday night. Whereas like now I'm just not interested in most of it. And it's the opposite, where it has to be like Barbie for me to go.
You have
like
to find a movie that you really want to see to go to the movie.
Yeah. I just don't, and it's because of the way like movies are produced now, that there isn't this variety of types. There's just, all there are is like these big, you know, superhero and reboot things, where it's like, that's not my thing. So we don't, like, I loved going to a nice romantic comedy or something.
Yeah. Well, but, you know, I mean, we could go on about that, but
no.
I don't like the movies that I see, like, for instance, the romantic comedy. So I went to see Fly Me to the Moon.
Mm-hmm.
I thought the first hour was great, and then it fell apart and I got really bored. They forgot.
We don't have like those masters doing. Maybe we need people to be practicing it more. I don't know what it is, but we don't really have as many like Nora Ephron type people who like
Billy Wilder, whatever. Yeah.
Are doing this thing and are so good at it. And I don't know what else is happening, if they're getting notes from the, you know, from
it's
the
gonna be this,
studio
that,
or whatever, you know.
Yeah, the suits are at work destroying. Mm-hmm.
But I really miss that. Like, I miss movies about human people doing human normal things.
I got really, like, I wasn't into Everything Everywhere All at Once, because I much preferred Past Lives, because that was a movie about how we only have one life to live, which is the truth. And movies about all the movies about multiverses, I find, well, you know, there really aren't any multiverses, people.
Yeah, it's true. It's really true. And it's just like nice to have those movies where they're just making a point. That's all I'm saying. Like, it's just nice to have a movie where you're like, oh, that, wow, that's really, you know, that really packs a wallop, or you really care about the characters, or you can name the characters later after you've seen the movie, you know, like that feeling. I really miss those kinds of things. And they don't have to, it doesn't have to, like, I just rewatched Pulp Fiction.
I did too.
Seen it in like 20 years.
It's really great.
And it's so good. Like, I know this is like, I mean, it's not news, like newsflash, this groundbreaking movie is really good, but I really didn't remember except the big iconic parts. And like, it just reminded, it's like still to this day, I can watch that movie and see how inventive it was. And then also how unbelievably influential it was. Like,
I had completely forgotten about
staggering.
Walken's part, and then he just made
yes, that was so Walken, because I feel like he's game for anything, and he's just like, sure, I will bring the resonance of my Vietnam movie to your weird little flashback scene that might not need to even be here. It's just, there's so many people in that. In fact, I'm going to tell you the funnest fact ever that I just learned.
Yeah.
I just learned that the actual, you know, the Kevin Bacon game, actual best connector in Hollywood currently is Samuel L. Jackson.
He's in everything.
Because he is prolific, but one of the major nodes of it is Pulp Fiction, because so many people in that movie then went on to do so many things. So you get your Bruce Willis connections, you get your Walken connections, and that dude's in everything too. So I just that was my favorite fact that I recently learned.
It's harder to play that 6 degrees game now because so many years have gone by.
Exactly.
I used to be able to do it with any two actors. Like you could just give me any two actors and I can do it.
You also have to know a lot of your movies, and I don't know movies as much as I used to. So, when I was going to the movies all the time, I was like such a whiz at that stuff.
Yeah. Well, we're talking with Jennifer Cation Armstrong, and she began her career, I think, at writing for Entertainment Weekly before. Was that your first professional writing?
No, I was actually a newspaper, like I was a local newspaper reporter before that. Fun
Oh, yeah.
fact about me. I'm putting it to use now because I'm writing a book about Parks and Rec. So it's like coming, the local news is coming back to me. But right after college, I worked at a couple, they were such quick jobs. It feels like there were a lot, but really it's like you're 1 year here, 1 year there. So I worked at a couple of local daily newspapers, which I'm actually really grateful for. And they told me when they hired me at Entertainment Weekly, the reason they hired me as the news and notes assistant was that I had hard news reporting experience. So that was very gratifying because it had been a very stressful couple of years. I do not recommend this job to anyone.
How long did you work at Entertainment Weekly? I mean, I remember
10
you about
years.
10 years. And
Yeah.
did you ever get a cover story or maybe
Oh,
more
yes.
cover stories? What was the first one?
I'm very proud of this. My editor claimed that I was like the first or one of the first assistants to get a cover story. Someone didn't want to, like, it was over Christmas that this had to happen. And so all of the senior people passed on it and I took it, which was Jessica Simpson and Nick Lachey when they had the reality smash Newlyweds. So I had to fly out between Christmas and New Year's to Los Angeles to hang out with them at their house in Calabasas, and that was my first cover story.
Isn't that great?
Yeah.
I was a big fan of Entertainment Weekly because in the same way that I liked the TV Guide preview issue, Entertainment Weekly came every week and
Yep.
told you stuff about what the movies and music and everything that was happening. I loved it. I
Yeah.
miss it.
Yeah, I loved it too. It was a dream job. Like it was on my list. That was like I couldn't even believe that that was remotely possible for me as a girl from the Midwest. But that was when my college advisor asked me what my dream job was. It was that or Rolling Stone. Very telling. Rolling Stone's like more glamorous,
Yeah.
but EW, man, it just there was something really so I would even when I still think about it, there was something very satisfying about getting that magazine, like you said, every week, and you could just look at it and be like, this is what I'm going to do. And it was funny and witty and smart, and it wasn't just kissing Hollywood's ass all the time, and you got
Yeah.
that feeling from it. And I just really, that to me was so exciting because, and I felt very defensive when people would ask me about my job and they didn't get it. Like when they would think that I did gossip or whatever, they'd be like, well, what's the gossip on Britney Spears or whatever. I was like, we don't do that. Which was true. Like that wasn't what we were interested in. We weren't interested in
That
beauty
was Us
tips.
magazine or whatever.
Yeah. And that was the heyday of that trashy, trashy, horrible, destructive cycle of tabloids. And so I was really proud to work at this place where I thought that we brought some depth to it. And now I feel like this is a more known thing too, like other places. We've had Vulture now, we have things like that. But at that time, when they first started, especially, nobody else was doing that.
Yeah. Are you still in touch with any of the colleagues that you?
All of the, like as so many, I always call it EW Mafia
Yeah.
because and it's but in a nice way
Yeah.
because everything I've ever gotten since is pretty much because of EW. I made foundational friends there. I was in my late 20s, so you can imagine, and I just moved to New York City, so like that was my social life. But also, we just still constantly give each other like jobs and all kinds of things. In particular, my former boss, Henry Goldblatt, I call him my fairy godfather. He is just constantly like, I do not know what I did to deserve this. But he just like, I work for the Peabody Awards now. I write their newsletter, and that is because he recommended me for that. So that's just a very clear, like that just happened in the last few years. And I've been out of that place since 2011. And so he works at Netflix now and will like throw me assignments, well-paid assignments to write about like Sex in the City, which I know so well, and it's really easy for me. So like I've been on, people's podcasts, because of it. Like, it's just such a beautiful thing that everyone still, we have a mutual respect for people who are there with us. And so we kind of just always give each other that treatment.
Was it like a bullpen? Did you actually go there and hang out?
Yep, we did. Much to my chagrin at the time, you know, remote work wasn't really a thing. So for good and bad, I think. Like, at times I would actually negotiate later in my career, when I'd been there for a while. I'd be like, I'm writing a cover story, I'm staying home, because I actually would get more done that way. But this is part of it, is like, it was so fun. On the other hand, it was like, you'd go to work, and I swear for the first year, especially, I would be like, how is this my job? You know, like the meetings, like, nobody likes meetings except when it's like, let's do the best deaths of all time from television. We're just going to talk about that for 2 hours. Like, that's so fun. And everyone there was so on top of their game. I just remember being blown away by, you know, the way that there was one guy who knew everything about the history of Disney. Like, that was his thing. And you would never guess it by meeting him. But then he would just be like, well, actually, in 1973, what happened? Well, you know, you just like, how is this possible? And the way that people just knew their niches and took everything seriously, it just was incredible. And so when kids would come to me, you know, college kids, and be like, oh, I want to work at Entertainment Weekly, I love movies, I'd always be like, you need to think about that, because movies are made for you to be liked. Like, that's what they're trying to do. So you need to think about the level that you like the movies. And if you like it enough, you better figure out what your area of expertise is and, you know, blow everybody else out of the water on it. Such a nerd.
A lot of times that, you know, if you find yourself working in a field that you once loved, it will make you hate it because you're working in it.
It does do that. Like, it does do something. I've said that before, and like, I would modulate the word hate. But like, it made it really hard, more so then than to me now. I've sort of gotten used to it, or maybe the pressure isn't as, you know, it's not like I'm writing for a weekly magazine. And so, you know, it makes you watch differently. I had to watch a lot of bad things, especially early, because they'd give you like the crappiest stuff to do.
Right.
You definitely would get sick of stuff. You definitely had to watch those shows nobody's heard of. And, you know, even just meeting celebrities is like kind of annoying in a lot of ways. You know, it's like,
right,
they can ruin their perception, your perception of them.
Better not to meet your heroes.
That's right. And you're often treated like crap. You're treated like you're not important in this scenario. And so like, a lot of that stuff, I hated red carpet reporting. Hated. I thought I would have loved that. And it was absolutely my worst nightmare, because you're just penned off like cattle, and like no one wants to talk to you, which is like my nightmare. It's just awful. So I'm not going to yell at people to talk to me. I'm just not going to do it. And so I would say,
is that how it was?
Yeah. I wouldn't do it. And so I like they just figured out that I was bad at it, and they wouldn't send me anymore.
So I can't believe we're running out of time, but tell me, what you're working on now is Parks and Rec?
Yes.
And what's that going to be? Is that show?
It's obviously a book about the show Parks and Recreation. And I was trying to remember when it's going to, I think it's due in early 2025, so it'll be out in 2026. It's really been fun. I mean, it's been fun in a million ways. Most notably, I actually negotiated access before I sold the book. So most people, I don't want to say everybody, because there's reasons that some people aren't, but the big ones are participating, like Mike Schur, the creator and co-creator, Greg Daniels, the co-creator, Amy Poehler, and Nick Offerman. They are all the most delightful humans you will ever encounter in your entire life. They're like a spiritual experience talking to these people. Nick Offerman is writing an intro for my book. It's so nice to live in this warm, wonderful world. It's also really interesting to think about this show in an election year. You know, it's really a relic of the Obama. It's a strong relic of the Obama era. It actually runs from 2009 to 2015. So it's exactly in the boundaries, like just after he got elected, it starts. And then just, you know, before Trump comes down the escalator, you know, it ends. And it has this incredibly Obama-esque optimistic view of how government can get things done. You know, Mike Schur talks a lot about incrementalism, and he feels that that's the bedrock of Obamaism, is like, you can't do everything, but if you just, you know, work really hard, you might make a small difference as a public official. And, you know, obviously Trumpism kind of like obliterated this view really quickly. And it felt like it was from 100 years ago all of a sudden. But I actually think it's kind of coming back too, this vision, you know, this sort of like, there's a very, I think, especially Walt's energy to Parks and Rec, kind of the regular Midwesterner getting things done kind of thing. And it's just, it's been a very interesting thing to think about in those terms. And I'm glad that I don't have to finish it until after the election, at least.
Good. Yeah. Well, let's hope that it, Trump,
hopefully we'll be feeling good.
And you also have, I think I'm lost count, but you have 17 podcasts.
I actually don't anymore. Which is a very simplifying thing. I did at one point have 17 podcasts. I'm consulting producer on the Peabody Awards podcast, We Disrupt This Broadcast. So you should all go check that out. And my new venture is that I've started a Substack collective with four of my author colleagues, pop culture author colleagues, called the Ministry of Pop Culture. I believe you've interviewed most of them.
So, I have.
Or some of them, at least.
I think I've had four of them. Or
oh, good. Okay. Well, there's only four of them, so you might have covered it. Yeah, it's been really fun. You know, we kind of felt like there weren't many places anymore. You know, media is really drying up. And there's just not that many places anymore to take our ideas about pop culture. And we all have really similar sensibilities in terms of pop culture being a really important part of our lives that can actually have an impact on our lives and that needs to be studied and that has a social impact as well. And so that's been really fun. We've done a lot of election stuff there too. We just had a really cool story that was about that, where we asked some of our TV writer friends to pitch how they would script the 2024 election, and they came up with some really good stuff.
Look at that. And yeah. That's on Substack.
That is on Substack. We are the Ministry of Pop Culture.
Great. And are you still doing your own pop culture Substack as well?
I do have a Substack as well, because I feel like it's important to have that place where I can just like speak to people who have actually signed up to hear about me. So,
well, I loved all the things that I've read that you did.
Thank you.
And it's always great to talk to you. Jennifer Cation Armstrong, she's the author of several books, all of which are worth reading, including the one we were talking about today, Mary and Lou and Rhoda and Ted, and all the brilliant minds who made the Mary Tyler Moore Show a classic, and her Seinfeld book, and her Sex and the City book, and her book about Mean Girls, which we didn't even mention, and the book that I absolutely love of hers, which is called When Women Invented Television. It's a great
thank
history.
You. I like that book too. That might be my favorite.
That's good. Well, thanks for chatting.
Thank you so much for having me.
Joining me now is From the Bookshelf contributor Lissa Warren. She is the president and founder of Lissa Warren PR, a company that specializes in book and author publicity. She's a professor at Emerson College in Boston. And she's active on Twitter, Lissa_Warren. I think I got it wrong, but she can correct me in a moment. Lissa Warren, welcome back to From the Bookshelf.
Thank you. And you actually had it right.
Oh, good. Yay.
Yay. What do you know?
Are you calling it Twitter or X?
I still call it Twitter, and I will call it Twitter until the day I die. Because when one calls it X and you want to say that you tweeted something or retweeted something, you're not going to say that you X'd something or re-X'd something. Like, nobody says that, right? So
exactly. And plus, X is something we somewhat associate with pornography.
That is true. And also, it's just sort of negative in connotation. Like,
right.
Why would a person, ex-husband or,
that's right.
You know.
Why would a person buy a company and then a successful company and change their name to something awful? But that's a topic for another day. I asked you here to tell me about a new book that you're working on, and would you please do so?
Sure, I would be happy to. There is a wonderful book called Morningside, The 1979 Greensboro Massacre and the Struggle for an American City's Soul. It's written by Aaron Shetterly, and it came out from HarperCollins, specifically their Amistad imprint, just a few days ago. So it is brand spanking new. Want me to tell you all about the book?
Please do. Morningside.
All right. Morningside. So on the morning of November 3rd, 1979, activists, mill workers, and supportive local citizens were gathering in Greensboro, North Carolina, at the Black public housing development that they have there called Morningside Homes, which, of course, is, you know, sort of a nod to the title of the book, Morningside, but also the title of the book just sort of suggests something new and maybe redemptive and hopeful. So it applies to both meanings. You'll see when I tell you more about it. So there were four television news crews that were set up across the street from the Morningside Homes development, and they were there to film the start of a Death to the Klan march. And shortly before 11:30 a.m., a nine-car caravan rolled toward the crowd. "Here comes the Klan," somebody yelled, and then the shooting started. 88 seconds later, five members of a multiracial communist group lay dead on the ground. Two were Jewish, one was Black, one was Cuban, and one was a very WASPy graduate from Harvard. And all of them were highly educated and deeply committed to anti-racism and economic equality. There were 10 others who were injured that day, including the group's leader, who was a longtime Greensboro civil rights activist, and his name is Nelson Johnson. Now, here's the kicker. You would think there would be all kinds of public outrage and people held to account and all of that. Well, Greensboro's mayor rushed to a local television station to announce that this terrible incident of American political violence was just an unfortunate accident. The real victim, he suggested, was Greensboro, home to the Quakers and an original depot of the Underground Railroad and some of the largest textile mills in the world. Like, he turned it into an ad for Greensboro. I mean, it was just terrible and tacky and cruel and heartless. No one, not even the Klan or the American Nazi shooters, would ever be held criminally responsible for the five murders. Now, I don't know if you'd ever heard of the Greensboro Race Massacre. I had never heard of the Greensboro Race Massacre. Had you heard of this?
No, and I was an adult in 1979. How could it have happened that I don't know anything about this?
That is a very good question. I believe that shortly after this occurred, there was another, newsworthy incident involving hostages, and it just sort of eclipsed what happened at Morningside Homes that day. But the 45th anniversary of this massacre is November 3rd. Like, it is coming up fast. And this is a really good opportunity to right the wrong that was done by sweeping history under the rug. He did a great job in this book. He's an historian. He is somebody who does deep research into archives, as you would expect one to do. But he also befriended Nelson and his wife, Nelson Johnson and his wife, activists both, and really got to know them and really got a firsthand account of what happened that day, which is so much more valuable than any archive could ever teach you. It's a remarkable book. It's been praised very widely already. It got a starred review from Publishers Weekly, and they don't give those out easily at all. And he's now touring all over the eastern side of the country, doing talks at libraries and bookstores and letting people know about this incident that occurred. But it really is just a tremendous book. I'm a big, big fan of it. And Aaron Shetterly, it turns out, this is sort of a little fun fact. The last name Shetterly, related to books, rings a bell at all. It might be because he is the husband of Margot Lee Shetterly, and she is the author of the New York Times number one bestseller, Hidden Figures. I don't know what their relationship is like. I'm sure they're very mutually supportive of their of each other's writing life.
Yeah.
But he's got big shoes to fill. You're like, that's, you know, that's number right. one New York Times bestseller. Holy cow, that's amazing.
All I wrote was this little book. Yeah.
Yeah, exactly. You know, yours will do fine, honey, I'm sure. But anyhow, yeah, they're really neat people, both of them, neat authors, both.
And that's great. And let's talk about the title again. Morningside, the 1979 Greensboro Massacre and the Struggle for an American City's Soul. And the author is Aaron Shetterly. Sounds like a fascinating book.
It's wonderful. I really liked it. I like history anyway, but boy, this was really good. And I love it when I find out about something I just never had even heard of that was so pivotal, you know, and so important. So anyway, yeah. I liked it a lot.
Well, good. Well, thank you for telling us about it. And I hope you'll come back and talk to us again on From the Bookshelf very soon. That's it for this week's From the Bookshelf. I hope you enjoyed the program and will come back and see us again next time. In the meantime, you can check out our website at fromthebookshelf.com. You can subscribe to our podcast wherever you subscribe to podcasts. You can even get your smart speaker to play From the Bookshelf by saying, "Alexa, play Gary Shapiro's From the Bookshelf." And she will. Until next time, for From the Bookshelf, I'm Gary Shapiro. Take care. See you soon.